Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with an Ohio State researcher about a new clinical trial involving Alzheimer's disease. He'll also have a conversation with an expert about the state of public schools in Columbus, and we'll hear about a program that gives shoes to Central Ohio kids in need. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective,
the Ohio State University is participating in a national clinical trial called Benfoteam to assess if benfotiamine, a synthetic vitamin B1, can treat mild cognitive impairment or early Alzheimer's disease by evaluating its effects on cognition and daily life. Joining us on Columbus Perspective is Dr. Douglas Shari, Director of the Division of Cognitive Neurology, Center for Cognitive and Memory Disorders at Ohio State, and also a Benfoteam investigator. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So did I pronounce it right? Benfotiamine? Perfect. Okay, good. What is it?
So it is a prodrug version of vitamin B1, which is thiamine, and it's designed to, it works very heavily in the memory circuits, which is why it's being used in Alzheimer's and mild cognitive issues, and it's very low in people that have Alzheimer's disease, and it's responsible, very important, this vitamin, for glucose, different metabolic pathways, this thing called oxidative stress, helps maybe with neuroinflammation, is designed to try to help the brain work better, especially when it's being toxified by these abnormal proteins that build up in Alzheimer's disease.
Now, this has been a disease that has been a conundrum for years. What does this new research show about the efficacy of a synthetic vitamin B1?
Well, so far, the earlier studies, this is still in the study, so we're trying to see if it, how well it works or if it does work. The previous studies basically showed it was very safe and well tolerated, and they were encouraging results in the earlier study and how Benfo is taken up by the brain. So it's doing exactly what was hoped for, that this synthetic vitamin B1 or thiamine can get into the right places in the brain so that it could be effective potentially in those circuitries and metabolisms that I mentioned.
If we think of the bloodstream as our internal plumbing for the body, the brain also is a plumbing mechanism. Does this synthetic vitamin B1 help to keep the pipes clean, metaphorically?
It's probably a little different than that metaphor, but yes, there's a, for Alzheimer's disease, what happens is you have these toxic proteins that build up and gunk up the brain, destroy the different energy pathways. So it's not, doesn't have anything to do with the actual blood vessel flow, but sort of the energy and sequences making the cell healthy. You need good glucose metabolisms to get your energy for your cells to make them work well, to prevent the toxicity of the inflammation that occurs in Alzheimer's with these toxic proteins. And so basically it's maybe a lubrication or something like that might be a better term, you know, for the mechanisms and the gears.
PBMs have been in the news a lot lately. These are these air particles that are plastic that somehow get into our body and end up in the brain. To what degree does that have an impact on Alzheimer's or cognitive dementia or this study?
As far as we know, it does not have any influence on any of those things, but it's unknown. The studies have not really been done. We've not been able to identify or say for sure that how and how much those types of particles can impact brain and brain functioning. But the current studies of research, as far as I know, has not given us a definitive answer for any of those questions.
Now, as it pertains to this current study, how far along are you and who's funding the study?
So this is funded by the National Institutes of Aging, and it's a consortium of groups across the country, mostly academic sites and people that have memory disorder centers. So it's a government-funded study, and it's in sort of the middle stages right now. We're collecting and recruiting individuals, still recruiting those that are interested in participating. We're very, very grateful for people with altruism that are willing to take the time and energy to try to help with clinical trials in general and to help particularly with Alzheimer's disease and getting better treatments out there for people.
Is there any potential that this study will be defunded based on what's going on in D.C.?
That is another thing I can't predict. So anything is possible. Alzheimer's has taken a hit somewhat in some corners, especially at the NIA. But this study is ongoing. It's been funded. So hopefully we'll continue the needed funding for this and all other important research that's being conducted.
Do you guys ever collaborate outside the United States?
It's possible. I don't recall if the study probably has Canadian sites. We normally have North American sites. I don't know off the top of my head whether Canada is involved in the study. My guess is probably, but I'm not sure.
How can people learn more about this Benfo team clinical trial if they want to sign up or if they have a relative who it's appropriate for?
Well, we'd be so grateful if they think of clinical trials and potentially the benefits of this clinical trial with benfotamine. People can get on the website. It's called benfoteam.org. Or if they're living close to Ohio State and around the central Ohio area, they can always reach our particular site. We have an email. It's called cognitive@osumc.edu. And either way, they can get more information about the trial, figure out what's involved, and decide if they want to participate or not.
There's always something interesting going on at my alma mater, The Ohio State University. And we want to thank Dr. Douglas Shari for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
The Columbus City School District is the largest in the state of Ohio, employing almost 3,300 teachers. While these teachers have a history of sparking a love for learning, the district has faced a teacher shortage crisis since COVID, forcing larger class sizes and the potential for decreased funding. Some teachers pay out of their own pockets for supplies and extras because they see themselves as champions of student success and also as vital leaders in our communities. Teacher Appreciation Week was the week of May 5th, and National Teacher Appreciation Day was May 6th. Becky Pringle, president of the National Education Association, joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
Why is this such a tough time to be a teacher, Becky?
Oh, my. You know, Jay, I taught middle-level learners the wonders of science for 31 years. So I know firsthand that it's always been hard to be a teacher because we know that our kids can't learn if they're not fit. We know that our kids can't learn if they're not healthy. We know our kids can't learn if they're struggling with issues in school or at home. And so teachers find themselves in a place where they're trying to meet all of those needs, stand in all of those gaps. And right now, those gaps are getting wider and wider as elected policymakers are taking away funding from our public schools and making it harder for teachers to stand in those gaps. They can't take that much money out of their paychecks. They need the funding that our students deserve so that they can live and grow and thrive.
Now, I know you're aware that there have been protests outside the Ohio State House about new federal education guidelines, state guidelines regarding higher education, and also proposed funding cuts or reallocations. What does this mean for the future of education in a state like Ohio?
It means in Ohio, and honestly, Jay, all across this country, that our work to ensure that we have a high-quality public education that is free to all is in danger. And whether we're talking about cutting funding at the state level there in Ohio or the federal funding that is being cut, not only in Education Day, but you've heard them talk about cutting Medicaid, and almost half of our students rely on Medicaid for their health care. So these funding cuts are very, very real. And then when we're talking about vouchers to private schools, that is further cutting the resources and support, the opportunities for our students. So it's very real, and it's happening right now, and it certainly is going to do nothing to help the education shortage that continues to plague Columbus and cities and rural areas all over this country.
Now, President Trump has actively advocated for the abolition of the Department of Education. And while we know that that doesn't necessarily mean public schools will cease to exist, hypothetically, what would happen if there were no more public schools in the United States of America?
Well, we are getting very dangerously close to that, Jay. And we know that public schools are the foundation of this or any democracy. We know how important it is for students to be able to think critically and solve problems collaboratively, to struggle with the challenges, the problems that we have today and that we will have tomorrow. We know our students have to be prepared for those careers that come after school, or if they've done all we've asked them to do and they want to go on to college, that they can afford it. All of that is in peril right now as this administration continues to not only threaten cuts, but those cuts have already happened. We've already seen special education teachers lose their jobs because of the cuts to research. We've already seen school districts making decisions to give out pink slips to educators before the end of the year because they are afraid that they won't get the funding that they need from the federal government.
For most public schools, the school year ends in early to mid-June. If you're a teacher in a public school system right now and you're looking at that end of the year, how likely are you to come back in the fall?
Oh, my goodness, Jay. It varies, honestly, depending on where you are. We don't talk a lot about our rural areas, which you have there in Ohio, and we have them all over the country. They've struggled for years to get teachers and other educators, support staff, just to drive their students to school. And with all of these cuts that are working their way through the funding bill in Congress, what we are asking, what we've asked, not just for Teacher Appreciation Week, but for all year, we want to show our teachers appreciation in action. And so we're asking them to work with us as we fight to promote, protect, and strengthen public education. Call your member of Congress and tell them not to cut funding for our students with disabilities. Tell them that they should not cut funding for our students who come from low-income families, and by all means tell them not to take funding away from our public schools. So we have focused on showing appreciation in action by asking our parents and community members and everyone to stand up for our public schools.
So while a shiny red apple on the desk is always nice and delicious, it's not enough.
It is delicious. But, you know, if you want to give one of those I Heart My Teacher mugs, put a little note in that mug saying that you already called your congressman and you already said that you support us by emailing your senator, and you already have reached out to others on social media to ask them to stand up for our students, for our teachers, for our public schools.
What is a good website for our listeners to go to follow up and get more information?
I would ask them to go to nea.org/protect. There they can find just a volume of resources, and they can learn how to take action, join us in our movement to promote protect and strengthen public education.
We want to thank Becky Pringle, the president of the National Education Association, for joining us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
One in five children in Franklin County live in poverty. For many of the kids who are growing up in those circumstances, having a decent pair of shoes is far from a given. In fact, research shows that more than two-thirds of children are wearing shoes that simply don't fit properly. And with kids between the ages of 4 and 14 outgrowing their shoes every 4 to 8 months, it's a need that doesn't go away and one that's extremely expensive. Rich Lally is the Partnerships Director at Operation Warm and joins us on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I am well, and my shoes fit, and that's a blessing. But for those who don't know, what is Operation Warm?
So Operation Warm is a 20-some-year-old nonprofit organization that works all over the United States and Canada to bring children living in need brand new shoes and brand new winter coats.
Why do new shoes matter for kids in need beyond just comfort?
Well, it's comfort and it's health and it's mental well-being, confidence. You know, when your feet hurt, it's hard to be at your best. It's hard to concentrate. And so if you're in school and your feet are hurting, you're not going to be able to concentrate on the lessons as well. And you're also not going to be able to fully participate in physical activities at recess and gym class.
So aside from that, you had talked briefly a minute ago about the mental anguish that comes with that particular circumstance. Wouldn't it just be simpler to have an older brother or an older sister just pass down some old shoes?
Well, the problem with old shoes is that those shoes have over time formed themselves to fit the foot of the child who originally had them. And so now you're putting your foot into somebody else's shoe and it just doesn't fit properly. And so you could end up with problems with your arches. You could end up with problems on the sides of your feet. And those things can accumulate over time. And then even as an adult, because of your ill-fitting shoes as a child, you can have foot problems for the rest of your life.
So when
that's why podiatrists strongly recommend that children get new shoes that are for them so that those shoes will fit them and over time mold to their foot.
And these shoes at Operation Warm are in fact new shoes.
Yes, they're all brand new shoes, and we actually have them manufactured to our specifications in a wide range of colors. We have about 12 different color combinations, so that if a little girl in first grade absolutely loves pink, she can have a pink pair of shoes. And if another guy wants to have a blue pair of shoes, he can have all blue with white trim or two colors of blue with white trim.
Where do you get the shoes? Who makes them?
We have them made for us by factories who make shoes for other people as well, but they're made to our specs and they're packaged in boxes the way we want them packaged so that they can facilitate shoe gifting events at schools and at nonprofit organizations.
Now, do you have to pay the manufacturer for the shoes or are they donated?
No, we pay for them. We do. Last year, we provided children with about 225,000 pairs of shoes. In the state of Ohio, we did about 40,000 pairs of shoes. And so the only way to do that efficiently is to we purchase them, we put them into bring them into a warehouse, and then they get shipped out to our distribution partners all across the U.S. and Canada. So we need funding to pay for those shoes. The good news is we're a nonprofit, so there's no profits associated with it, that 100% of the revenue that we bring in is used to get shoes directly to children who need them.
Where have you derived funding from in the past?
We get funding from all kinds of different sources. We get it from caring individuals. We get it from community groups like Rotary Clubs and labor unions. And we get it from some government organizations. We get them from corporations and foundations. So we have a very diverse group of supporters who support the work we do.
How does a parent find you? And what do they have to do to qualify to request a pair of shoes for their child?
So we are not what you would call a direct service provider. We don't provide shoes directly to families in need. We provide shoes to schools and nonprofit organizations that serve low-income families. So if you're, you know, a family that needs shoes for their children, the best place to go is to the children's school and ask them if they're in touch with Operation Warm. And if they're not, then that, you know, suggest to them that that school go to operationwarm.org and complete an application on our wish list.
How often is it that the teacher or the principal actually takes the initiative on behalf of the student when they're facing potential absentee parent problems?
You know, we have a tremendous amount of demand for our products. Our shoes last year, we had requests for 700,000 pairs of shoes. But as I said a minute ago, we only distributed about 225,000. So the demand that there is for these products far exceeds our ability to meet them. But the more, you know, the more funding partners we can find, the more children we can serve.
If we want to make a donation or perhaps volunteer in some capacity, where can we go to learn more?
Yeah, so at operationwarm.org, that's Operation Warm, warm as in not cold, .org. You go to the website there, and there's all kinds of information. There's obviously a place front and center where you can make a monetary donation, and $25 provides a brand new pair of shoes with two pairs of socks to a child living in need, and those, that has a retail value of about $50. You can also find information about how your organization, if you are with a church or a service club or a union local who wants to participate with us, you can learn how to be a community partner. If you're an organization serving low-income children, you can fill out one of our wish lists. And we do have volunteering opportunities. We call them our community impact volunteers, and there's an application to on the website for that as well.
Rich, this is absolutely wonderful. We want to thank you and the folks at Operation Warm. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
The primary election is still a full year away, but the race for Ohio governor saw some major developments recently. As we've reported on 10 TV News, the Ohio Republican Party voted to endorse Vivek Ramaswamy as the next governor of the state of Ohio. The endorsement comes very early in the gubernatorial primary cycle. Ramaswamy won the vote decisively. The party's state central committee voted 60-3 in favor of him. President Donald Trump has already endorsed the biotech entrepreneur and former presidential candidate as well. Right now, two other Republicans are running for governor, businesswoman Heather Hill and Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost. On the day of the endorsement vote, Yost's campaign manager issued the following statement congratulating Ramaswamy and saying the attorney general is going to take a few days to consult with supporters about the path forward. She went on to say Ohioans deserve a choice, not a premature coronation of an untested candidate. I checked with the campaign. A spokesperson said they have no new news to report at this time. Ohio Lieutenant Governor and former Ohio State football coach Jim Tressel is not ruling out a run for governor. In a statement, Tressel said he has not decided if he is running, but for now he is focused on helping Ohioans get off the sidelines and into the workforce. And at this time, former Ohio Department of Health Director Amy Acton is the only Democrat who has announced she's running for governor. Dr. Acton became well known for helping guide Ohioans through the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. Both she and Republican candidate Heather Hill have recently appeared as guests on Face the State. Joining me now to discuss the race are Democratic strategist Morgan Harper from Washington, D.C. I want to mention that Morgan is based here in Columbus, but is in D.C. right now for work. And Republican strategist Ryan Steubenrausch is here in studio with me. Thank you both for joining me today. Well, let's
Thanks
start.
For having us.
You're very welcome. Let's start with you, Ryan. I want to know, what are your thoughts right off the bat as far as the endorsement vote for Vivek Ramaswamy and how overwhelming it was?
Well, it certainly wasn't close. There was some talk ahead of time, some newspaper reports about Governor DeWine perhaps trying to slow down the endorsement process, but we all saw how that worked, 60-3. It's rather decisive. And so it's early. There's still a year. That's almost an eternity in the political world. However, an endorsement from Donald Trump plus an endorsement from the Ohio Republican Party is going to be a major obstacle for any person to ever overcome.
And talking about, you know, the earliness of this, what does it mean for Ramaswamy, both symbolically but also practically? What kind of resources does that give him?
Yeah, so the endorsement from the Ohio Republican Party comes with a lot of things. Obviously, there's, you know, staff help and things like that that the Ohio Republican Party can provide, cheaper ways to send direct mail using the nonprofit stamp that the party has. But the most important thing, for the most part, is all of the slate cards, we call, you know, the little mailers that you get that say, hey, here's all the endorsed Republicans. Those get sent to Republican voters. That's the most likely communication that most people are going to look at. And obviously, we know who's going to be at the top of that.
And Morgan, I want to bring you in here. What do you think right now is the way things are shaping up on the Republican side of this and, you know, the power that's building behind Ramaswamy?
I agree with Ryan. I mean, I think the 1-2 punch of a Donald Trump, well, actually 1-2-3 punch of Donald Trump endorsement, Donald Trump Jr.'s endorsement, and the Ohio Republican Party is quite a hurdle for anyone else to have to clear to try to really compete with Vivek Ramaswamy. And more than that, I mean, and this is something for us to pay attention to as Democrats. I think we also need to be wary of the messaging that's coming out of Vivek Ramaswamy's campaign. He's talking about whether or not we think it's true or it's a grift. He's talking about the future. He's talking about investing in children in Ohio. He's talking about making Ohio competitive, bringing people from other states to want to live here. And so I think it's going to be very important to focus on economic issues as we build out the opposition campaign here.
Ryan, on the Republican side now, you know, Dave Yost is a strong candidate, but what does the endorsements mean for Ramaswamy in terms of what his campaign is? What do you think is going to happen there?
So Dave Yost has been in Ohio politics here for a long time, you know, served on his second term as attorney general. He's raised a lot of money for this race. But, you know, he's smart enough to understand reality. And so we saw recent reports that he was considering an appointment from the Trump administration. The statement after the endorsement was not exactly a full-throated challenge. And so I don't know what Dave Yost is going to do. He's had a long and successful career. I'm sure whatever he does, he'll do it well. But, you know, between him or even Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel, if he wants to get in the race, it's, you know, it's getting late early here. Things
really
better early. Get moving. Yeah.
Really early. Well, since you mentioned Tressel, is he still a wild card in this?
Yeah, no, listen, Jim Tressel, you know, I don't want to compare him to Donald Trump, but he's a non-political person up until just recently. They always had the nickname for him as Senator.
Right.
So, you know, not quite Senator, but perhaps Governor Tressel, I'm sure sounds good to some. So he is very well known, not nearly as much as Donald Trump. And he certainly would have the ability to raise some money and garner a lot of support. And so that's the kind of candidate where it would be possible. But it's still an awful long shot, especially, you know, without any formal announcement or campaign infrastructure just yet.
Like you said, we still have a full year before the primary. So, Morgan, how do you think Dr. Amy Acton's campaign is going so far at this time?
Well, before I get to that, I did just want to make one more point building off of Ryan. I mean, I think we have to also take into account the retaliatory nature of the political environment living in right now. Anyone who was going to make that decision to support someone like a Jim Tressel is now not only going against Vivek Ramaswamy, but as we were just discussing, is going against the entire MAGA movement and Donald Trump movement. And I don't know that anyone's going to want to fully be on the record to do that, or there might be more limited support. Regarding, you know, Amy Acton's campaign, look, I mean, we need to have a Democrat who's running, who is being honest about the state of affairs for the Democratic Party in Ohio. It is not a good one. And if we're going to have a shot at this thing, then we have to radically change how we are approaching these races, what we're talking about, and who we're presenting. And it's got to be an anti-establishment campaign. I think Vivek has the advantage of both having all of this backing of what now runs Republican politics nationally in Ohio, which is MAGA and Donald Trump. But he can also say that he is an anti-establishment guy, that he's not part of Washington, that he hasn't been part of traditional Republican politics in Ohio, which hasn't gone well for the average Ohioan, but he hasn't been that guy. And so, you know, that puts him in a pretty advantageous spot narratively, I would say. And that's going to be something that Amy Acton's going to have to get a lot more aggressive about combating with a real populist message.
Do you expect other candidates to enter the race on the Democratic side?
It's hard to say. I mean, we're hearing a lot of speculation. I think Tim Ryan has now kind of gone on the record saying that he's considering it. And so we could see other people entering. But, you know, given these dynamics on the Republican side, I would really caution that whoever is thinking about it should make a decision quickly so that we can sort this out and really start to rally the resources to mount a competitive campaign.
And Sherrod Brown, of course, the former longtime senator from Ohio, hasn't ruled anything out yet. Are you hearing anything in your circles about his potential plans, whether it be for governor or for senator?
Yeah, that's speculation that I've been hearing, too. Impossible to speak for Senator Sherrod Brown's plans directly. But, you know, what I'm hearing more than anything in my circles, which is really a lot of folks that are just doing the work of the party on the ground and organizing and beyond that, just organizing communities, regardless of if it's in a political context, is there's a real hunger for change. I mean, I think if we look at the local primary elections that happened in Columbus recently, that about 60% of people were voting against the city council endorsed candidate. I mean, that is a sign of people wanting change from the typical Democratic way of doing things. And we shouldn't ignore that as we're thinking about some of the statewide strategy, because there is no path to a Democrat winning in Ohio without really running up the numbers in Franklin County.
What do you think about that, Ryan?
Well, a number of things she said there. Number one, I think Amy Acton, you know, nothing to take away from her, but she's not winning this race for governor. An outsider might be a great shot, but a person with whom most people still associate a not so great experience in COVID. Sherrod Brown or Tim Ryan, either one of those two are probably more likely to get into either the Senate or the governor race or both between the two of them. But let's be honest, those two men are they lost the last two times statewide. And it's the third time around for the same election. And barring a significant change in Donald Trump's popularity, in the red nature of Ohio, it's going to turn out the same way here.
Is that one of the concerns, though, about the popularity of the president right now? Because it is so far out, he's doing a lot of stuff in his first 100 now plus days. That still has to play out. So are you watching that closely in terms of, you know, maybe the effects it has on the economy and support for him?
Yeah, something that Morgan said, the path for a Democrat to win in Ohio is right now closed. The only possible path to go back to 2006 is a terrible economy sliding into recession, massive unpopularity with Donald Trump. And, you know, after the president wins an election, the president's party usually loses in the midterm. Mm-hmm. And so that's the only hope that the Democrats have. Now, it's a year, it's a long time, but so far, we're not seeing that.
Yeah, and that's actually not until the general election, so a year and a half even,
right,
in terms of how that can all play out. Morgan, what do you think about that situation here that Ryan was just talking about?
I agree that that's a necessary part of the calculus here for a Democrat to really be competitive in this race, but I don't think it's sufficient. I think in addition, I don't wish that scenario happened for any of us, but it does appear that the president seems intent on very erratic economic policymaking that really is endangering the financial stability of the country and the average American. And if we do get to the point of having a significant downturn, something like a recession, I think that's the only thing that creates the opportunity for some folks to maybe move away from the president's support. I mean, some of the numbers we're seeing from Ohio independents right now seems to be tracking pretty closely with a lot of the tariff policy, you know, kind of like adding support to that observation that it's probably going to be influenced by economics. But what I mean by necessary but not sufficient is, you know, to take advantage of that opportunity, we also have to have a really strong campaign that's speaking to where the people of Ohio are at and that we're presenting a vision for the future that people also want to buy into. Because another risk for us as Democrats that we've seen from these last few elections is that, yes, we have lost people who have moved to Donald Trump and Republican statewide candidates that have his support, but we also are losing people to just opting out of voting altogether. And what is going to motivate them to show up? And that requires an affirmative vision, again, for the future. And that's the kind of thing, like I said, I mean, even if we don't think it's true, even if we think it's a grift, Vivek is talking that language, and we have to be prepared to have a very strong counter vision.
And Ryan, we'll end with you. Just 15 seconds left. Final thoughts on that spreading gap between Republican and Democratic voters here in Ohio.
Yeah, if Democrats over the last 5-10 years have moved considerably left. And to get through a Democratic primary, you have to believe and advocate for things that is not supported by the majority of Ohioans. And if that never changes, they'll never win again.
Ryan Steubenrausch here in studio with me, Morgan Harper on Zoom from Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being here today. Some very interesting perspective on the race for Ohio governor.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
In recent weeks, Republican Senator Bernie Moreno and Republican Congressman Mike Kerry have appeared as guests on Face the State. This week, I'm turning the focus to the other side of the aisle. I recently had a wide-ranging interview with 3rd District Congresswoman Democrat Joyce Beatty. We talked about President Trump's trip to the Middle East, tariffs, and a push to put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. We started with potential cuts to Medicaid and Head Start.
The president and other Republicans have said that budget cuts will not impact Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. Do you still have concerns that that will happen?
Oh, I definitely have concerns. As you probably know, Medicaid and Medicare, that comes under our Energy and Commerce Committee. And here's what I know. If we take Medicaid, for example, and we look at almost 40% of our Ohioans are dependent on Medicaid. And I think it's important, Doug, for people to know, we're talking about sick children. We're talking about the great work that happens right here at home at Nationwide Children. And then when you think about hospitals and healthcare, nursing homes, they are also dependent to the tune of some 65%. Now you tell me, when I'm sitting here in Washington and they're talking about cutting $800 billion out of that budget, I think it's ridiculous that anybody and any Republican would try to tell with us what they're doing is not going to be harmful and we shouldn't worry, then I want to hear them say this, and elections have consequences. The American people are not going to accept that.
Some pushback in response to reports that the president may eliminate funding for Head Start in his budget request. Do you think a cut is likely?
Well, we are, again, fighting tooth and nail against that. We know when you go back to the early 1960s when Head Start started, and you can look at the research to see that this program worked. Children were advanced when they went into schools. You know, when we look at it, it was in Project 2025. And here's what I need people to know. Most people understood that Project 2025 was harmful, and it was all about cutting hardworking American people. It was an attack on minority communities. It was an attack on how and what our children would do in school.
What do you make of the president's current trip to the Middle East and some of the deals he's announced, including the $600 billion investment deal with Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think it speaks for itself where it is, and it falls right into the thing of total control. You know, he has us up against a trade war. When we look at what he's doing with his taxes and his tariffs, he meets with folks who have not been an ally to us. He's stirring the pot internationally. And so I think we should be concerned because this is all about corruption. He's brokering deals that will not sit well with us and some of our allies.
The administration recently announced it will lower the tariffs on China from the 145% back to 30%, and China will reduce its from 125 to 10%. Do you think that's a good deal for America?
I don't know if not, because I don't know what to believe. But here's what I think happened. You know, China bit back. When Trump got out there and he was saying what he was going to do, he thought China would roll over. But what they did was they hit us hard. The American people started complaining because what it was doing to businesses. Just the other day, I was in a car dealership and they were saying they're afraid of what's going to happen to their products. The beer and wine people came in and said they no longer from international places that they've traditionally ordered from, they're afraid because when they order it, and what happens at the purchase of receiving it, at the point of receiving it, they don't know what they're going to be hit with. And so I think what has happened now, because China bit back, it caused Donald Trump and his cronies to then come up with the numbers that you just gave. We don't know what to believe, because tomorrow it could be something different.
You've been very passionate about getting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. Where does that stand right now, and why is it so important to you?
I think it's important for a variety of reasons. There was a national survey of who should go on the $20 bill, because as you know, every decade or so, they go through revamping, and it takes a long process with the security codes and the things that we would do. And throughout several administrations, even when Republicans were in control, it was decided that Harriet Tubman would be put on the $20 bill, or a like image of her would be put on one side of it. And as we've worked through Secretary Treasuries, through the Obama, the Biden, the Trump in 2017, everybody was on board with this. And so as you probably witnessed in committee the other day, when I talked to the secretary, it was clear that he didn't even know what I was talking about. And that was very disappointing to me, because a commitment had been made that we should be in the final productions of this. And I think it's important for us to be able to say to America, and not only Black Americans, that this is something that will give us a greater sense of knowing in this wonderful country we live on. And we can also see us, and for my grandchildren and others coming up, I think it's important.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan, and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.